In the months after the bombing of Pearl Harbor and America's entry into World War II, there was an urgent need by the Army and Navy to staff up in deciphering clandestine messages sent by the Japanese and German militaries. And we'll learn about the code breakers in just a bit. But first, let's take a moment to rally around the year-end membership drive here at Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Kate Archer-Kent here with my colleague Mike Crane. We are in our year-end membership drive. This is your public radio station, listener-supported Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now is your chance to make sure we get a good start to 2018. You make WPR programs possible as we head into the new year when you pledge right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Thanks to everybody who pledged in the last hour, new and returning members. It's great to hear from you. While we have an incentive to get more people to do that right now, because we have a dollar-for-dollar match up to $6,000. It's a generous match from members of the 9XM Leadership Circle, including Zach and Emily from Madison, and listeners from Shawano and Hazelhurst. And it means that they will match every dollar you give.
Wow, that is so exciting. It certainly adds energy in the air here of our pledge drive. It's their way of encouraging you to join them in supporting Wisconsin Public Radio. Double your support for the programs you love. Give right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You know, in many ways, it's good to get more. And one of the things that you get more of is more content on Wisconsin Public Radio because we're commercial free. But that means we depend on other sources of funding. Yes, there's state and federal and a little bit of corporate funding. They're really important. And there is another source that's really important, too.
Here's the deal. The single largest piece of the budget pie, that comes from you. Your support makes all the difference. It is the backbone of our funding. It is listener support that does the heavy lifting here. Make your pledge right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Think about when you first discovered Wisconsin Public Radio. Maybe someone said, hey, have you checked out the WPR app? Or said, listen to this NPR One thing? Or you found it on the radio because mom and dad had it on in the front of the car?
Yeah, that they did.
All kinds of ways that we found public radio. But, you know, you're listening now, and my guess is you're hooked.
You probably are. And whether it's been years or just a few months since you found us, your contribution of, say, $10 a month or $120, it supports the quality programming that you valued since the first time you listened. So be part of making WPR possible. Give right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Here at Wisconsin Public Radio, we've been partnering with food banks throughout Wisconsin since 2010 to help those in need. President and CEO of Second Harvest Food Bank, Dan Stein, shares the universal impact of hunger.
In the lines that we see veterans, we see seniors, we see people with physical ailments, we see families. There isn't one category, but the one thing they have in common is they're all struggling.
This drive, when you give $10 or $20 a month, consider asking for a food bank thank you gift. It's your chance to do two good things at once.
Get in touch, WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Mike Crane here with Kate Archer-Kent reminding you that listener support is the single biggest source of funding for the Ideas Network. And that's why your support during WPR's year-end membership drive is so important. Maybe your gift can be $20 a month. You decide, because whatever amount you choose, that's the right amount.
We know you value your time. We value your time as well. So giving to Wisconsin Public Radio takes just a few minutes. We need your name, your contact information, how much you want to give, and how you'd like to pay.
It's really easy to do, and your gift right now really helps. So take the next few minutes to support the station you count on at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And we must say our dollar-for-dollar match is in effect right now. Give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552, and your support of WPR will go twice as far.
And don't forget, we've heard about this, the food bank gifts. When you give $10 or $20 a month, you'll be providing meals to those in need in your area while also supporting WPR. Give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Support your WPR listening. Contribute right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And thanks. On this Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day, we're going to explore the lives of women who signed loyalty and secrecy oaths, pledging to never reveal details of their work as codebreakers during World War II. Upwards of 10,000 American women served the Army and the Navy as codebreakers during wartime. New York Times bestselling author Liza Mundy unearthed their stories in her latest book, Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. Liza, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, explain for us the background here of what it means to be a codebreaker. What were these women doing in the military during World War II?
Well, it's important to understand that World War II was a war of signals. It was a war in which armies and navies were spread out all over the globe. You know, for thousands of miles, commanders would have to communicate with troops and sailors. The German U-boat commander had to communicate with all of his U-boat captains. Politicians and diplomats were communicating. And most of this was taking place over the radio waves, you know, the same way that it would be taking place over computer lines today. It was traveling through the airwaves. And so they were encoding and enciphering these communications every day, thousands of signals being sent every day. So both sides in the war were attempting to snatch each other's signals and try to penetrate their enemy communications. And we happened to have a massive cohort of women who were recruited to do this work. So there were more than 10,000 women who came to Washington, D.C. and worked in two giant code-breaking compounds to read military messages, naval, army, diplomatic messages that were incredibly important coming out of Europe, every kind of communication that you can think of. And some of them were numeric and involved a lot of math. Some of them were alphabetic and also involved math and you needed people with a talent for math and languages and also a high level of persistence and tolerance for frustration.
I like the questioning of recruiting these women. Do you like crosswords? If you said yes, that was a good thing. Are you in marriage? And if they said no, it sounded like they might have a possibility of finding a woman who could do this.
Yes, immediately after Pearl Harbor, and even a little bit before, the Navy knew that it needed to completely ramp up its code-breaking operation. And Pearl Harbor, of course, was a terrible shock and surprise. And it exposed the fact that we had very little intelligence capacity, which is so hard to believe today because we have so many intelligence agencies. But back when we were entering the war, we had very little. So the Navy started secretly recruiting college seniors from the Seven Sisters schools of the Northeast and some other women's colleges. And those women would be asked, just as you said, do you like crossword puzzles and are you engaged to be married? And some of the women lied to the second question. They were, in fact, engaged. But whatever they were being invited to do sounded a lot more interesting than waiting around to see if their brothers and their boyfriends would survive the fighting, when, in fact, they could be doing something to help bring them home.
In the process of writing your book, you were able to find some of these women who are living and take their oral histories. There's one woman, Dot Braden, and she received a letter of acceptance that talked about cryptography. She had no idea what that word meant. Can you give us a sense of what Dot did in the war?
Yes, Dot was one of hundreds of Southern school teachers. The U.S. Army had responsibility for breaking the codes of the Japanese army that was spread out on islands and land masses all over the Pacific, and they were being supplied by ship. So as the U.S. Navy was recruiting women from women's colleges in the Northeast, the Army went forth and sent its handsomest young officers to recruit Southern and Midwestern school teachers to come to Washington and break the codes of the ships that were supplying the Japanese army. And they thought that the young school teachers would be susceptible to the charms of a handsome man. But in fact, many of these young women, you know, school teaching was the only job often available to a college-educated woman. These women were eager to leave low-paying, high-stress school teaching jobs and come to Washington and make more money, serve the war effort, bring their brothers home. That's what Dot was interested in doing, was both of her brothers were serving the military, and she wanted to serve the war effort like them. And so she was breaking the message systems that were controlling and also announcing the movements and positions of the thousands of ships that were bringing food or oil or spare parts or reinforcements to the Japanese army troops all over the Pacific. And the success of those school teachers in breaking the messages, and then the Pentagon would get the intelligence out to American submarine commanders in the Pacific, that had an enormous impact on the outcome of the war in the Pacific.
Dot, though, was hesitant to talk with you.
Right. Because
why was that?
When these women came to Washington, they were told the first thing they had to do, in addition to signing a loyalty oath to the U.S. government, was to sign a secrecy oath, saying that they would not then nor ever talk about what they had done. Code breaking was top secret. Of course, you don't want the enemy to know that that you're breaking his code system. And so the women were told to say that they were secretaries, that the work they did in these compounds was menial and unimportant. And because they were women, people believed them. And the penalty for disclosing classified information during wartime, that was treason, and the penalty would be death. And after the war, the women were told never to talk about what they did. The secrecy oath, in fact, was lifted later on in the century, but nobody told the women. Mm. So when I found Dot, I had to convince her that she wouldn't be put in prison if she finally talked to me about the work that she did.
What age was Dot when you did find her?
She was a very spunky 94, and she's 97 today.
Because their work was classified, it sounds like their contributions also received little attention, and you had to go through quite a bit of effort to get the boxes and boxes of materials and memos. How was that effort to getting this information so you could write your book? And have we lost sight of these women's achievements in World War II because this was so much on the down low?
Oh, absolutely. We lost sight of it. And as I said, nobody tracked the women down. Many of them had retired into private life. Many of the men during the war went on to have public careers. And so some of the men began writing memoirs, ultimately, of their code breaking, and the women didn't. And so they got really written out of history. And when I tracked 20 of the women down, I've heard from many more since my book was published, I was concerned about whether I would be able to substantiate their memories with documents and with a paper record. But it turned out, to my surprise, that the vast code-breaking archives that exist in our National Archives at College Park, which many historians had been through to write histories of code-breaking in the Atlantic and the Pacific, that there was ample documentation of the women's efforts and the women's contribution that really had been neglected. And then on top of the records that had already been declassified, I filed a lot of Freedom of Information Act requests with the NSA, the National Security Agency, which is the modern equivalent of the wartime code breaking. It's the agency that came out of that very successful effort. And so I got more than 20 oral histories that had been taken over the years with some of these women. I got them declassified, and other really valuable histories declassified as well. And it was remarkable how it was possible to substantiate virtually everything that they remembered.
these women also then, because of their secrecy, because they had to be, you know, work in such secrecy after the war, it sounds like they lost out on some of the benefits that people in the military would have received, like the GI Bill.
Right. So the women who, these school teachers or ex-school teachers who were breaking codes of the Japanese supply ships, they remained civilians for the most part. The Army preferred to have its codebreakers be civilians for various reasons. And that was good in a way because it meant that their workplace was not hierarchical. And if a 22-year-old woman was particularly talented, she might find herself in charge of a unit of 100 people. And those women after the war, for the most part, they were ushered back into the private sector, which had been the intent all along, that this would, you know, that women's incursion into the workplace during World War II would be a temporary measure. The Navy code-breaking effort, which was incredibly important as well, and keep in mind that this was more than 10,000 women altogether, those women, for the most part, did join the Navy, and they did qualify for GI benefits after the war. Their ability to avail themselves of that benefit was spotty. Some of them did get college degrees or graduate degrees as a result, but one of the women codebreakers whose memoir I read, she was incredibly important. Her work sank an entire convoy, a naval convoy, but she wanted to go to architecture school after the war. She already had her college degree, and she applied to several leading architecture schools hoping to use her GI Bill, and she was told that they were saving all the spaces for returning men. And she said, well, you know, I was in the Navy as well, and they didn't care. And so she was shut out of that. And she, of course, she couldn't tell them that her work had sunk a convoy and was every bit as important as the work the men had done. She was, you know, she abided by her oath of secrecy. So she was shut out of the graduate schools that she wanted to attend. She ended up teaching herself computer coding, and she ended up being in charge of the computer system at the University of Cincinnati. So that's the kind of, you know, intelligence and resourcefulness that these women displayed. And they were, you know, they were not rewarded after the war the way that they should have been.
Some of the women scoured encrypted messages in order to unscramble coded puzzles to help the U.S. determine the whereabouts of Japanese supply ships. Some women tested the security of America's coded messages. These women were vital to the war effort, and now their stories are brought to light in the new book by Liza Mundy. It's called Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. You can join in with your questions, your insights, 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the top secret work of women codebreakers during World War II? Do you think it matters that the people cracking secret messages were women? How do you imagine they felt at a time when they weren't, you know, in that role? 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll be back in a moment. The Army and Navy recruited at least 10,000 women after the bombing of Pearl Harbor and offered them unique opportunities to do urgent work for the country. The women were the heart and soul of the military's cryptanalysis, and they were learning. We're learning about female codebreakers of World War II this hour. But first, let's get an update on the Wisconsin Public Radio year-end membership drive. This is listener-supported Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and it is our year-end membership drive. If you've been putting off donating to WPR in 2017, now is your time to take action. And if you have given or you're a sustainer, make a special gift. It'll take just a few minutes at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
It's Mike Crane here, too. And, you know, we have a dollar-for-dollar match going on, Kate. It's in effect right now from 9XM Leadership Circle members, including Zach and Emily from Madison and listeners from Shawano and Hazelhurst. Your gift of $50 would turn into $100 for WPR. $100 turns into $200. You get the idea. Take advantage of this match right now and double your support for WPR programs by giving right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Every day, our team works very hard to bring you a great morning of radio. And that is a true pleasure on our part because we know that you're curious and intelligent. You ask insightful questions. We also know you like to have fun and enjoy all that Wisconsin has to offer.
Thank you for being a terrific audience and for being the reason we do what we do. You can give one more thing. You're giving your attention, which is awesome. How about your financial support? Your support makes these mornings possible. So give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And it's a season of giving, and you can do two good things when you give to Wisconsin Public Radio today. Your donation will support the programs you rely on, and you can ask for one of the food bank gifts. There are options available at $10 or $20 a month.
And these thank you gifts provide meals to those facing hunger in your area through regional food banks. It all starts with your gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Around the holidays, you may have bought some strange gifts.
So I have a friend that loves butter, and I'm giving her a book about butter.
Not really sure what she expected me to do with the card table, and that's kind of a weird gift for a seven-year-old.
I did get a pair of socks from my cousin, except it was like 4 months late, which, you know, it was a bummer to get a pair of socks in April.
This holiday season, consider a much more practical gift. Support Wisconsin Public Radio today. Your tax-deductible gift makes the radio service you rely on possible. Give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
It's so easy to get in touch with us and make that pledge, and it is practical because it's part of your everyday life listening to WPR and the Ideas Network. I'm Mike Crane, here with Kate Archer-Kent, inviting you to make a pledge. How about $40 a month? I'm just picking that number out of the hat, honestly. Any amount that works for you is terrific. We're going to keep making suggestions. $100 a month for a 9XM Leadership Circle, of course, is a great idea. The real reason is because the single largest source of WPR funding is listeners. Your gift is important to keep the Ideas Network going strong.
And that your gift is being matched right now, dollar for dollar. How about if you find out if your employer will match your donation as well? Pledge now and then check with your human resources department.
And even if retired employees can actually, in many cases, qualify as well for those employer matches. So pledge now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And then go ahead and find out if you can get your pledge doubled by your employer.
As I said before, our dollar for dollar match is still in effect. We have a good chunk left of it to raise.
Yeah, a little more than $3,000.
Yeah. So give right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552, and your support of WPR will go twice as far.
We'd love to hear from you. It's the season of giving. Do something extra by choosing that food bank gift with a pledge of $10 or $20 a month at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. You'll be making a difference for WPR and for those facing hunger in your area.
And if you're a sustaining member, thank you so much. Make today the day you increase your support of WPR by $5 or $10 a month or whatever amount you choose at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And thank you so much for your support. We're learning about the thousands of women during World War II who worked to develop methods of interpreting codes on this Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day. Codes are words that are switched when one word means something else. Code Girls is the title, the untold story of the American women codebreakers of World War II. Author Liza Mundy stays with us for the conversation on what these women did and how they helped America's wartime effort. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the top secret work of women codebreakers during World War II? Join in or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to Wallace now, who joins us from Weyerhaeuser. Hi, Wallace.
Yes, I have to comment on the wonderful job that these ladies did, because I was a naval flyer in the latter part of World War II, and at the time we didn't know how efficiently they were working. However, when they broke the code of the Japanese, when they sent the four massive carriers to invade Midway, and it is known today as the Battle for Midway, the Japanese were unaware that the U.S. naval forces were setting a trap for them, and when they sunk those three carriers and wrecked the other one, it was the turning point in the naval warfare over Japan. I have to comment, these ladies, what a wonderful job they did.
Liza, go ahead.
You know, it is so meaningful to hear a man call in and thank the women. This is the first time that's happened, actually. And I've been giving talks around the country, and often it happens that in the audience there's a woman who did this work or the family of a woman who did this work. But your caller is the first man who was in the war who has called to thank the women for what they did. And that's just an incredibly meaningful comment. And I thank him so much for calling in and obviously for his service to our country.
Liza, these women were extremely successful, and as Wallace mentioned, they helped sink ships. What was going on there?
Right. So there were women who were breaking the messages of the supply ships that were supplying the Japanese army. That's what my central character, Dot Braden, were doing. There were other women who were breaking messages that were determining the movements of the Japanese naval ships, just as your caller, Wallace, said. There were so many different code and cipher systems being used, but the example of both of those systems, the Japanese Army and Japanese Navy systems, were what were called super enciphered code. So a word like Maru or battleship or aircraft carrier would be rendered by the Japanese as a 4 or 5 digit code group. So it might be like 6721. And then the Japanese would add another set of digits to that to encipher it. So this was an early form of what we call today encryption. And it was the job of the women to strip off the encryption. So they were decrypting those messages and then get down to the original code group and then figure out what the numbers stood for. And this was an ever-changing effort because the Japanese would periodically change their code books. So the code group that stood, say, for battleship would change. So they had to constantly be updating, not just stripping out the additive, the number that had been added, and decrypting the message, but they had to constantly be figuring out anew what a certain code group stood for. And some of the women that I interviewed remembered specific messages, kinds of messages they would look for. One woman remembered something that was called a Shogoichi message, and that was where a Japanese naval ship captain would announce his noon position, where he would be exactly in the Pacific Ocean at noon the next day. What better piece of intelligence for an American submarine commander? And so she would get that message decrypted, the intelligence would be radioed to the American submarine commander, and he would be waiting when the Japanese ship appeared at noon the next day.
Let's talk about the contributions of Agnes Driscoll. What did Agnes Driscoll figure out that led to a victory in the Battle of Midway?
Right. And just as your caller said, the Battle of Midway was one of the great code-breaking triumphs of the war and of all time. It turned the tide of events in the Pacific, and it was one of the most famous sea battles of all time. And it is thanks, in large part, to a woman named Agnes Driscoll, who was a Texas school teacher who worked as a civilian for the U.S. Navy during the 1930s, diagnosing the Japanese Naval Fleet Code, figuring out that it was this system that's called a super enciphered code system, where they were using the digit groups and then enciphering them with more numbers. She basically reverse engineered that system and diagnosed how it worked. And it was a largely thankless job. At the time, before World War II, code breaking was a kind of small and obscure endeavor. It wasn't prestigious. It wasn't the kind of job you wanted to have if you were a naval officer. You wanted to be, out there commanding ships and on the ocean. And so because she was a woman, because she was a civilian, she was kind of stuck at that desk. But it was thanks to her genius that we understood how the Japanese naval code system worked, and we were able to decipher those messages before the Battle of Midway and anticipate where the Japanese were going to be. And the male officers in the Pacific who were doing that work all credited Agnes Driscoll for teaching them how to be code breakers and for diagnosing how the system worked.
What machines did women code breakers work with, and how did their days look like, and how often did they work?
They worked around the clock. These were 24 hours. This was during the war. Code breaking was a 24-hour, massive, around-the-clock effort. So the women for the Navy worked what they called watches, which was, you know, 8 hours during the middle of the night or in the morning or the afternoon. The civilian women called them shifts, and they were working always, and they were, you know, they were having fun and letting off steam in their off hours, but it was a completely absorbing around the clock effort.
We've been talking about these thousands of women during World War II who led the cryptanalysis effort and made a huge impact on intelligence operations during World War II. We'll be coming back to the Code Girls conversation with author Liza Mundy. But first, let's get an update on the Wisconsin Public Radio year-end pledge drive. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and here with my colleague, Mike Crane. This is listener-supported Wisconsin Public Radio. Our year-end membership drive is a time to think about how much you've learned from and enjoyed WPR programs in 2017, and to think about how you want to keep them going strong in 2018. And then take action with your gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Boy, it's really great listening to this conversation with Liza Mundy and thinking of that call from Wallace. That was so appropriate. Thank you, Wallace, for your call. We just love to hear from our callers participating in making the Ideas Network strong. And those of you listening, we're asking you to take advantage of our dollar-for-dollar match and supporting the programs that you love on WPR.
Take a few minutes to make this hour many more hours possible. Choose a gift amount that works for you, then make your pledge. It will be doubled at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Well, Kate, we're about halfway, just a little bit more than halfway toward our dollar-for-dollar match goal. It's up to $6,000. It's in effect right now thanks to some pledges from 9XM Leadership Circle members, including Zach and Emily from Madison, and listeners from Shawano and Hazelhurst, who will double every dollar you give. Double the impact of your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And a great way to share your passion for WPR is becoming a member of the 9XM Leadership Circle with a pledge of $100 a month. $1,200 a year or more. Sorry about that math there. We rely on member support. It is your support that makes great radio.
All the gifts are important, including these gifts of $100 a month. Help us to stay strong at WPR and continue to grow with your leadership gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
My name's Meg Marshall, and I'm from Weyerhaeuser, Wisconsin. I think today, especially with this crazy world we live in, it's more important than ever that people know what's going on in the world. This is not just about the United States, it's about the entire world. And the only place you find coverage of international issues to the depth that you find them on Wisconsin Public Radio is right here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Meg from Weyerhaeuser, Wisconsin. Join me as a sustainer of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's easy to become a sustainer, WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Make your sustainer donation or a one-time donation. Maybe make an additional gift to end out this wonderful year of listening. Mike Crane here with Kate Archer-Kent, raising the money to pay for the Ideas Network. So how about pledging $10 a month or $100 a month and we'll be very appreciative, and we'll also be counting on your gift.
Help keep WPR strong as we enter 2018. Become a first-time donor or make an extra year-end gift to support the programs that you value. Give right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Let's make sure that we take advantage of that dollar-for-dollar match. We've got about $3,600 raised so far toward that $6,000 match. So give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And your support of WPR, so important. And thank you so much for listening and contributing right now, taking advantage of the match at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. These were women who were recruited for their math skills, their knack for recognizing patterns. These women were instrumental in winning battles at sea and sinking Japanese supply ships. We're talking about the code breakers on this Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day. Liza Mundy's new book is Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. You can join in with your questions, or perhaps you knew a codebreaker from World War II. 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Liza, how did the dynamic between men and women affect women breaking codes?
Well, it's in many ways, actually. The women were, when they were recruited for the effort, they were told, never to talk about what they did. They were told that they would be shot if they talked about their classified top secret work during wartime. And as I said, they were told to tell people that they were secretaries. Anybody who asked them what to do and what they did in their giant wired compounds in the Washington, D.C. area, they were to say that they sharpened pencils and emptied waste baskets and filled ink wells. And ironically enough, because they were women, people just accepted that. People naturally accepted that the work a woman did couldn't be important. And so it made them in some ways the ideal intelligence officers, communications intelligence in particular, because people just weren't suspicious that they were doing, in fact, urgent and stressful and extremely important work. There was also a belief that women were good at tedious low-level work, that men were the geniuses, who would have the bold strokes of inspiration, and that women were good at tasks that required a lot of careful attention, but didn't involve genius. And so, in fact, that's obviously not the case. And these code-breaking efforts were massive group efforts, and it did require a lot of care and attention. But it was, in fact, the care and attention that people exhibited when they were studying all these, masses of code groups and numbers. It was that care and attention that would lead to the strokes of inspiration. So there were so many female geniuses and absolute brilliant women working on this effort, making really significant breakthroughs. So those were some of the sort of stereotypes about women that worked against them, but, in some cases, ironically enough, made their lives a little bit easier and made it easier for them to keep the secret.
One of the geniuses you write about is Anne Cara Christie. She was in her early 20s and wound up leading an Army research unit.
Yes, she was recruited out of Russell Sage College in New York, in suburban New York. She was 22 years old, an English major, when she came to Washington. But she was the daughter of a businessman and an inventor, and she clearly had engineering and technical and pattern recognition smarts in her family. Women in college at the time were often not permitted or encouraged to go into math or engineering because those careers were not going to be available to them. So, that may be why she was an English major, but she was very gifted at language, but also at patterns and puzzles. And she helped break a code system that there was a specific set of numbers that were at the beginning of every Japanese Army message. That was the address that the message came from, and it was the address that it was being sent to. And that was like on a letter,
But that gives you a lot of information and more time about where the enemy is headquartered, where new units might be being formed. If one unit is writing another unit, that might indicate that an action is about to happen. And she, working with a West Virginia school teacher, they broke that code system, and they were able to help compile a intelligence report for the Pentagon every day, enumerating the what they called order of battle, which was a description every day of where the Japanese army was located, where it was headquartered, where other units were set up, and whether they were anybody was likely to be on the move. And so at age 23, she was supervising a unit of many people who were working on the Japanese address codes. And she would actually stay with the work after the war. This operation became the National Security Agency. There was an important cohort of women who never left this work, who stayed with the work after the war, broke codes all during the Cold War, and rose to very high positions. And Anne Kerr Christie would become the first female deputy director of the NSA. So she was an important early intelligence figure in Washington, D.C. And the intelligence community had a lot of women working in it who came out of the war.
And so she had this upward trajectory as the first female deputy director of the National Security Agency. After the war, did other code breakers stay in Washington, or did they go back to their homes? And then did they go back to motherhood, perhaps?
Yes, a lot of them went to motherhood, generally for the first time. There was a lot of pressure on women to leave the workplace after the war. It had been sort of assumed all along that female incursion into the workplace would be temporary. The president of Goucher College said during the war that he got a request from a defense company for 20 female engineers with the instructions to select beautiful ones, for we don't want them on our hands after the war. So I guess the thinking was that a beautiful woman would be more likely to get married and leave the workplace. So there was a lot of pressure on women to leave the workplace when they got married, but even more so when they had children. And some of the women in my book did go on to work for the NSA after the war, but if they started having children, they really were expected to leave that work. There was no support system. During the war, we actually had government-sponsored childcare. That was immediately ended after the war. So women in the 1950s really had to choose. And so the women who stayed with the NSA and did code-breaking work, generally of communist countries during the Cold War, they usually had to choose a family or work. So many of the women, like Anne Kerr Christie, who devoted their careers to intelligence work, made the decision basically to stay unmarried and to not have a family, not have children.
Women, they crack codes and they save lives, but that also happened at a cost. American troops killed enemy soldiers based on their information. And you write that sometimes women managed to break a code, but they had no ability to stop the carnage about to take place against the Allied forces. What lasting effect did code breaking have on these women?
Well, it was very stressful, urgent work. And some of the women after the war who had done incredibly important work, they would be haunted by, you know, the lives that they hadn't managed to save. Because these women were also decrypting American messages that had casualty lists. They were reading the names of the men who were killed in action. In some cases, they were breaking messages. There was one woman, a naval woman, who broke the message, or she was the watch officer, when a message was broke saying that her brother's ship was about to be targeted by a kamikaze raid. And there was, of course, nothing that they could do about that. And his ship was sunk. He did survive, but she was haunted after the war by thoughts of lives she had been unable to save. There were other women who knew that their work had sunk Japanese ships and sunk convoys. And during the war, that was a tremendously exciting or satisfying thing for the women to know. The Japanese were our enemy. That was, they had started the war. That was the viewpoint. But later on in life, some of those women would reflect that their actions, you know, had led to the deaths of young Japanese men and that their families had grieved for them. And their feelings about what they did, they didn't regret it, but they did have complex feelings about their work. And again, because this was secret and they couldn't tell anybody what they had done, they just really couldn't talk about it. So they didn't have any kind of an outlet to process those feelings. There was no recognition of something like PTSD. There was no psychological counseling. So they just had to really sort of live with this.
The Rosie the Riveter imagery from World War II is iconic. We can see her image in our head. We don't see posters of women codebreakers from then or now. Why is their work different than women who left the home for the assembly line?
That is a really good question. And I guess that's because we didn't know about it, because it was top secret. But it's important to keep in mind that women were doing high-level intellectual work during the war in any number of venues. They were basically pioneering our computer industry. And you're right, we know about the women who were riveting and working in factories and building the bombers and the tanks, but there were women who were working as engineers. They were designing blueprints. They were running early computers. And so we continue to have these absurd debates about whether women really belong in the tech sector today, which is so ironic because so much of our tech industry came out of World War II. These early computers were designed to either break codes or calculate weapons trajectories. And it was women who were programming those computers and pushing forward that computer work. Women like Grace Hopper, who was with the Navy, and she's finally getting credit for her computing, pioneering computing work during the war. So you're right, we do need a poster, and we need an image of the women who were doing incredibly important brain work and technical work during World War II, so that we can understand that women not only belong in these fields, but that they pioneered fields like cybersecurity, which is what this was, and computer programming and other computer work.
Well, Liza, thank you so much for spending time with us and for bringing this story to light.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Liza Mundy is New York Times bestselling author. Her new book is Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. Liza Mundy has written two other books, and she's a former longtime reporter for The Washington Post. This hour of the morning show was produced by Keely Baltina. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. You're with us on the Ideas Network. And now let's get an update on the Wisconsin Public Radio year-end pledge drive that is in full swing. And I'm joined here in the studio with Mike Crane. We're raising the money that keeps Wisconsin Public Radio and all the programs you enjoy on the air. Whether your pledge is $10 a month or $100 a month, we appreciate and we truly count on your gift.
It was really fun to listen to the show today and thinking, you know, we talked about Rosie the Riveter, right? Mm. So now I'm thinking of Dottie the Decoder, that just this remarkable work that we've learned about. It's so great that it's come to light. And for us, listening to the Ideas Network, it came to light right here on the radio or on our phone as we're listening through the app. It's made possible by you. And because you value the conversations that we have on this show, we invite you to pledge your support.
Now take a few minutes to make this hour and many more hours possible. I'm glancing up here. I believe, yes, we still have match money on the table, more than $1,000 there, so that your gift can be matched. Choose a gift amount that works for you, then make your pledge right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We'd love to hear from you. Thanks so much to the 9XM Leadership Circle members who have put this dollar-for-dollar match into place, Zach and Emily from Madison, as well as listeners from Shawano and Hazelhurst. So there's still a chance for you to put your $200 in and then have it mean $400 for WPR, or whatever amount works for you. $50 would be terrific. Mm-hmm. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Since we launched our Sustainer program, thousands of members have made the switch to providing a steady, reliable stream of support to WPR through automatic monthly gifts. That kind of giving comes with benefits.
Well, for example, when the pledge drive comes on, you don't have to wonder, is it time for me to renew? That's because your sustaining membership automatically rolls over and your support is always current unless you decide you don't want to do it anymore. Become a sustainer today at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 and provide reliable support for the Ideas Network with a gift of $10 or $20 a month or whatever amount you choose.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent here with Mike Crane. Listener support is the single biggest source of funding for WPR programs that you rely on, and that's why your support during this year-end membership drive is so important. Maybe your gift is $10 or $20 a month. Whatever amount you choose, that is the right amount.
Now, when was your first time listening to public radio? I know what mine was. I remember I heard this person who was talking differently than anyone else I'd ever heard on the radio. Later, I realized it was Susan Stamberg on All Things Considered. And we all have memories like that. Maybe you were hearing it on your parents' radio, or you were in the back seat of the car.
Or the theme song meant it was time to wake up from nap.
There you go.
Of All Things Considered, right?
That's right. And listening to the Ideas Network, or maybe before that to Let's Draw or Let's Sing. Since you've been listening, you've become hooked. You can't get enough of the in-depth conversations, the music, the great entertainment.
Now that you're all grown up, it's your turn to become a member like your parents are to help pay for the hours of high-quality programming you've enjoyed day after day, year after year. Join the WPR family. You can get your donation. Oh, wait, we have just made our match.
Woot, woot.
That is very exciting. Support the radio that's been a part of your life since you can remember. Start with a gift of $10 a month or a one-time gift of $120. Go to WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And thank you so much for your support.